Sri Aurobindo, in this chapter, this is actually the second last chapter. We are almost close to the end of the book. And here he is talking about the kind of transformations that would ensue if the supramental consciousness became stabilized in the human being and formed what he's calling here the Gnostic being. So first he talked about the various transformations of the psychology, the inner mind, life, and physical constituents. But then he raises the question about the life. And basically these parts are a prelude to the next chapter, which is what he calls the divine life. Essentially that sort of brings to a culmination the whole book, which is called the Life Divine. And so the whole thesis of the work is hinging around this question about whether there can be a divine life and what are the conditions of such a divine life. So we see that for Sri Aurobindo, such a divine life is premised on the individual. So individual transformation ultimately, you know, has been attempted by numbers of people, mystics to various degrees, but this has not really made an appreciable difference to our world, except for the creation of certain moral codes of conduct to make life a little more civilized. And on the other hand, mystic schools, which have allowed the few who have sought other kinds of experiences to, go through certain disciplines that would give them these experiences. But he has raised this question from a universal point of view as the destiny of the human being, as a possibility towards which history is moving, and raises this question both from a doubtful point of view, which is that we can see that, you know, through the millennia, human beings have existed but have not ever held up the ideal of a wholesale transformation of humanity into some kind of spiritual life. It has always been seen as a goal for the few. So that being one particular aspect, the other aspect has to do with, you know, whether individual change can really influence a large number of people. So these two questions are at the back of this entire chapter. He starts with the individual change, and there itself he has already gone through the various conditions under which a human psyche or human psychology can be transformed sufficiently to make a difference to the conditions of ignorance that we find ourselves encased in. Human beings have something conscious in them, but a lot that is unconscious. And whatever we do, we may come into contact with something, you know, very stupendously conscious, universally conscious, and yet that is a sporadic or a transient experience. And ultimately we fall back to our condition, which is a middle ground of, mixture of ignorance and truth. So the question that he feels he answers by talking about this supramental consciousness, which in a sense lies beyond the dualities of ignorance. He foregrounds this by talking about it in an evolutionary fashion, that whatever it is that we experience in this evolving ignorance, this evolutionary consciousness, is a certain kind of idea, what he calls the real idea, a real idea of supermind, for working out a certain possibility of becoming, a possibility of becoming which arises out of a zero condition of forgetting and gradually develops its own structures of consciousness that endure within this forgetting. to a point where, you know, even individually, there can be a reversal of consciousness and a gradual control over the instruments of nature. So this is what ultimately leads to the notion of the Gnostic being who brings this perfect image. One may call this archetype, divine archetype of the human, to bear on the instruments of nature, transforming them positively. Now this archetype, divine archetype, if you want to call it that, has three stations according to Shumbu. One is an inner and individual station, which is what one might call the soul. The soul or psychic being is, one may say, the image of God in man, in which man has been made. And so it is an individualized appearance of the divine which backgrounds the complexity of our nature. And there becomes the first secure ground, anchor of the divine life. To be able to contact that, to bring that to the front, to have it influence and control the instruments of nature, would be the first provisional anchor of the individual in the cosmic ignorance. But nevertheless, it would do is it would bring to the experience of the individual a certain sacredness, a certain presence of the divine lurking behind things in the ignorant world, but not mastery over the cosmos or its forces. So the second real station of this divine archetype is in what he calls the cosmic being. The cosmic being can be thought of as the single being who is evolving in this universe. So the entire universe can be thought of as the body of God. At its center is a being. And that being is the cosmic being, or what he calls the cosmic Purusha, or sometimes the overmental Purusha. So union of the individual, union is also a kind of not a 100% proper term. It's more like the recognition or identification of the individual with the cosmic being is or even the remembrance of the individual of its identity with cosmic being brings the individual into a certain void. It knows itself to be a center of the all being. He uses the term the all in that case. That is, the containing idea, which master idea, which overrides all things in the cosmos. So in contact with that, there is a certain universality in which one can come into understanding of all things and also exercise to a large degree power of unity, at least of harmony. But even there, these powers are constrained by certain universal laws. These universal laws are cosmic laws which give relative freedom to truth and falsehood, to knowledge and ignorance, to virtue and sin, in this world of dualities. So even here, one can accept this world as a veiled play of God, a play of God in which one knows that there is only one player that is playing, but one has to accept the conditions of the play, which is the conditions of a rather cruel ignorance in the world. But beyond this, there is a third station, which is the transcendental station, the station of mystery, the supramental, where the form or the archetype at that point is that of the one. So here, you know, these are the three categorizations, we may say. At the bottom is the each. The each implies infinite fragmentation. At the second, at the mediating point or the mediary point, we have the all. The all implies the cosmic becoming. And at the transcendental point, we have the one. The one implies the mystery that has become the all and the each. So out of that, in union with that, it is not merely a union in consciousness, but a union in totality. This integral union is in knowledge will. In other words, it knows itself to be the one, and it can exercise this oneness everywhere. This exercising of the oneness as will can change the conditions of the ignorance. It knows itself to be the all, the one, and the each. And in that triple knowledge, it can exercise its oneness to unveil the condition of ignorance. This is the point that he's making about the Gnostic being. And after talking about the psychological transformation, he asks this question about the divine life as to what are its possibilities in terms of personality. Is the each, is the individual, going to lose its individuality? If we are talking about this vast universality, is this universal being something which erases the sense of the individual? That is one question that he asked. The other one he asked had to do with action, good and evil. What happens to individual action and morality in terms of what we do to others? What is truly the meaning of the formula beyond good and evil? So these are the two questions he has asked and answered so far, and he is continuing to deal with these questions. The question about personality and impersonality, as well as of good and evil. First, the personality and impersonality he has addressed by talking about the fact that in the one, there is both the all and the each. So the experience of the transcendental empowers the individual as well as the cosmic. So you know yourself to be cosmic, but at the same time, you know yourself to be a specific formulation or a specific choice of the infinite one. And then as far as the good and evil formulation goes, he points out that this duality belongs to the cosmic ignorance, and that in union with the one, there can be no duality of this kind, because all action is the action of the one that knows itself everywhere. In such a condition, there cannot be error, because this dispersion of the one is replaced by this sense of the intimate one everywhere. See? So that necessitates a harmonious action which can only be good and does not have the duality in it. So this is where we were. And in this paragraph that we are taking up right now, he is continuing to address this issue of the triple status of the Gnostic being.
So, shall we begin by reading that paragraph?
Sure.
I can start. The supramental consciousness must be fundamentally a truth consciousness, a direct and inherent awareness of the truth of being and the truth of things. It is a power of the infinite, knowing and working out its finites, a power of the universal, knowing and working out its oneness and detail, its cosmicity and its individualities. Self-possessed of truth, it would not have to seek for the truth or suffer from the liability to miss it, as does the mind of the ignorant. The evolved Gnostic being would have entered into the truth consciousness of the infinite and universal, and it would be that which would determine for him and in him all his individual seeing and action. His would be a consciousness of universal identity and a consequent or rather inherent truth knowledge, truth sight, truth feeling, truth will, truth sense, and truth dynamism of action, implicit in his identity with the one or spontaneously arising from his identity with the All. His life would be a movement in the steps of a spiritual liberty and largeness, replacing the law of the mental idea and the law of vital and physical need and desire and the compulsion of surrounding life. His life and action would be bound by nothing else than the divine wisdom and will acting on him and in him according to its true consciousness. An absence of an imposed construction of law might be expected to lead in the life of the human ignorance, because of the separativeness of the human ego and its smallness, the necessity it feels to impinge on and possess and utilize other life, to a chaos of conflict, license, and egoistic disorder. But this could not exist in the life of the Gnostic being. For in the Gnostic truth consciousness of a supramental being, there must necessarily be a true revelation of all the parts and movements of being, whether the being of the individual or the being of any Gnostic collectivity, a spontaneous and luminous oneness and wholeness in all the movements of the consciousness and all the action of the life. There could be no strife of the members, for not only the knowledge and will consciousness, but the heart consciousness and life consciousness and body consciousness, what are in us the emotional, vital or physical parts of nature, would be included in this integrated harmony of wholeness and oneness. In our language, we might say that the supermind knowledge will of the Gnostic being would have a perfect control of the mind, heart, life and body. But this description could apply only to the transitional stage when the supernature was remolding these members into its own nature. Once that transition was concluded, there would be no need of control, for all would be one unified consciousness and therefore would act as a whole in spontaneous integrality and unity.
So, in a way, this is a continuation of what we were discussing, the fact of the supramental consciousness being the truth consciousness, that is at once transcendental, universal and individual, and being itself everywhere, in the one, in the all and in the each. And over here he points to two movements in that, a movement in which there is a gradual evolution of this truth consciousness in the being, and one in which this evolution completes itself and is established. So one may say that in the first, there is a evolution in which there is a development of universality and sense of the cosmic in all things, but there is also a sense of difference, and the sense of difference is something which necessitates exercising of the power of unity on those elements that have their individual wills. But gradually that is replaced by this power of identity, which is the supramental knowledge will, as he calls it. There is no distinction there between knowing and willing. Both are a single movement. And as that establishes itself, stabilizes in the nature, one finds that there is not even any question of governance, but there is a spontaneous, natural sense of the one in every way. And here he talks about, again, he's bringing back in this beautiful paragraph, he's actually bringing together a lot of the earlier things in this chapter, because he's brought the psychology back into it, these various disparate parts of our being, like the part of mind, the part of heart, the part of will, and the part of the body, each with a different modality of consciousness. This is the point he has made about mind seeking for knowledge and having a certain type of consciousness. Mind knows and experiences in a certain way, as per what he calls the mental purusha, the way of the mental purusha, the way of the mental being. Then you have the emotional being, which has its own kind of knowledge and own kind of experience that follows another dharma or law of being, of purusha. And then you have what he calls the vital being proper, which is the law of the will, which is also independent in a way, and can act independently of mind or feeling in the experience of power in the world. And finally, you have a body which has its own understanding, knowledge, and experience of things. these modalities of consciousness are then, in this particular case, not necessarily subject to each other, but spontaneously identified.
Devashita, we can't hear you.
Hello?
Yeah, we just lost you the last 5 seconds, maybe.
Yeah, I was saying mind, heart, life and body, each of them in their own modalities experience this one identity consciousness with all things in their own ways. So that is the establishment of the supramental consciousness in the nature, when there is no need to dominate or act upon the consciousness from above, but a spontaneous law of identity manifesting in these parts.
Devashita?
Yes, Shah.
Yeah. So, when he says that, you know, there's no need of a control itself, but still, that consciousness does have to interact with other consciousness which are not of the same material, right?
Yeah, undoubtedly. Now, when he's talking about this, spontaneous action, yes. It's about the person in whom this particular consciousness has established itself.
Okay.
So it's essentially that stage is that of what he has called the supramental transformation. Mm-hmm. Once the supramental transformation has occurred in an individual, to that person there is this kind of condition. But also that condition, if it is complete enough, can have its influence on the cosmic forces. So it can naturally, you know, sort of, I mean, set up vibrations that cause the environment, cause even distant realities to express the power of the truth consciousness. So this is, of course, to talk in these terms is a very distant thing, and it also is something achieved only through stages. But it's also part of the, this is what we were discussing last time, about one man's perfection yet may change the world, which is that, in a sense, if this completes itself, that instinctive power of truth in all the parts of the being would have an influence on its own components in other beings, so that a kind of yogic development would be engendered in them. This is the entire hope of the integral yoga. In a way, the integral yoga as the yoga, or the supramental yoga, was something that Sri Aurobindo embarked upon primarily because he felt he wanted what he called a world-transforming yoga. A world-transforming yoga is only possible if there is a power that can override in some way individual contrary will, the contrary wills of the individual. Most human beings are not even interested in anything greater than what their normal experience is. And, you know, even those who have idealisms would rather remain in a kind of a muddy, half ignorant condition along with their idealism. It's very difficult to develop an aspiration to overcome the ego and experience these grand things that he's talking about. So that's why, and he also says that the great messengers of God have come and gone, but it is still Rudra who holds the earth in the palm of his hands. And peace on earth cannot be till the heart of man deserves peace. And that is something which pertains to this fact that, you know, the great teachers have left some sort of influence, have left a teaching and an influence. But the weight of ignorance is so great in the individual that it is something which draws towards, it's a gravitation towards death, towards ignorance. So here what he's pointing out is that it's only when a certain power can enter, which is the instinctive knowledge of truth, the instinctive knowledge of the one being in mind, life and body, even if it establishes itself fully in one person, it has the power of awakening itself in others. That may take time, but essentially it is that invisible power which is the whole secret of world transformation, that it can cause people to move invisibly towards yoga, because there's a power of oneness that is generated invisibly within them due to its presence in the earth atmosphere.
Vince, would you like to read next?
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
So we must acknowledge there could be no conflict between self-affirmation of the ego and a control by super-ego. For since in his action of life, the Gnostic individual would at once express himself, his truth would be, and work out the divine will, since he did know the divine as his true self and source and constituent of his spiritual individuality. These two springs of his conduct would not only be simultaneous in a single action, but they would be one and the same motor force. This motive power would act in each circumstance according to the truth of the circumstance. With each being, according to its name, nature, relation, and each event, according to the demand of the divine will upon that event. For all here is the result of a complexus and a close nexus of many forces of one force. And the Gnostic consciousness in truth will conceive the truth of these forces, of each and of all together, and put forth the necessary impact or intervention on the complex of forces to carry out what was really to be done through itself, that and no more. In consequence of the identity present everywhere, ruling everything and harmonizing all diversities, there will be no play of a separative ego bent on its own separate self-affirmation. The will of the self of the Gnostic being would be one with the will of Ishvara. It would not be a separative or contrary self-will. It would have the joy of action and resolve, but would be free from all ego claim, attachment to action, or demand of resolve. It would do what it saw had to be done and was moved to do. In mental nature, there can be an opposition or disparity between self-effort and obedience to a higher will. There, the self or apparent person sees itself as different from the supreme being, will, or person. But here, the person is being of the being, and opposition and disparity does not arise. The action of the person is the action of the Ishvara in the person, of the one animated, and there can be no reason for a separative assertion of self-will or pride of independence.
So just as earlier he had raised the issue of the person versus the impersonal being, the universal being and the erasure of person, that the two are not you know, can the person and the personal being can coexist? Here he's reformulating that very reality in terms of freedom and order. And this, of course, he has also chosen earlier. He has touched on this earlier. But here is where he develops this in the case of the person. And we have seen that, again, as far as the individual goes, the sense of the individual freedom is that of a separative ego. Now, here in the very beginning, he uses the term ego, and he also uses the term superego. Now, in that use over there, it has to be recognized that he's using the term self-affirmation of the ego as its original philosophical sense of a monad, of a single individual entity of consciousness. And he's using the term superego not in terms of the Freudian sense of the word superego, but more like what has sometimes been called the transcendental ego, or if we can talk of a divine person or a universal person, that monadic reality, that individuality, that is what he's calling the superego over here. It is to be recognized that Sigmund Freud uses the term superego. It's a very important term in his psychology. And it actually, in his usage, stands for what he calls the father figure, the ideal of the symbolic center through which we construct our ideals. In other words, that the superego, in Freudian sense, is some kind of internal regulative power that we introject, that we receive into our own minds from our upbringing, and that we try to live up to. So this is not what he's calling superego. The similarity lies in the fact that it is a superior ordering or controlling consciousness in the individual. The individual ego, on the other hand, is not always, even in the Freudian sense, it is not always in harmony with the superego. So it is, sometimes in conflict with it, most often in conflict with it, and has a kind of a relationship of anxiety with the superego. Now here, in this case, he is talking about the superego more in terms of a divine center of universal individuality. And the ego as the individual center that in our normal experience is separated from any such divine true center. Now here he's saying there will be no distinction between the two. Or rather, even if there is distinction, they will arise out of a knowledge of identity. That's what we were discussing earlier, in that there is a certain status in which the cosmic all being, if you want to call it that, and the individual each are experienced at the same time to be one's identity. So this is what he talks about as being the same motor force that is at work in the universe as well as in the individual, or at work in a variety of different circumstances or in a variety of different people. It is experienced to be the same motor force. Now, the motor force term is a very powerful term because he wants to bring to our attention the fact, again, that this is not merely a perception. A perception can be free from a will, but a motor force is both active and passive. It is perceptive and transformative. So from that point of view, this particular experience brings a certain sense of self which at once perceives its unity with the all, and at the same time imposes that unity on the individual expression. So individual expression has its own uniqueness, but is in harmony with the all movement, with the sense of self which belongs to the all. So this is the point he's making over here. And he makes it in contrast with the life in the ignorance, where mental consciousness creates a division which is experienced as the separative ego that, you know, chafes at the bit and wants to be free from any sense of control. So this idea of freedom and control, the root at the origin of the problem of freedom and control, lies in fact this particular problem of consciousness, the problem of the each and the all. And it is only in the knowledge of identity, which is a dynamic knowledge, that that particular problem becomes solved in this case.
Louise, what do you want to read next?
Sure. On this fact that the divine knowledge and force, the supreme supernature, would act to the Gnostic being with his full participation, is founded the freedom of the Gnostic being. It is this unity that gives him his liberty. The freedom from law, including moral law, so frequently affirmed of the spiritual being, is founded on this unity of its will with the will of the eternal. All the mental standards would disappear because all necessary for them would cease. The higher authentic law of identity with the divine self and identity with all beings would have replaced them. There would be no question of selfishness or altruism of oneself and others, since all are seen and felt as oneself, and only the supreme truth and good decided would be done. There would be in the action a pervasive feeling of a self-existent universal love, sympathy, oneness, but the feeling would penetrate, color, and move in the act, not solely dominate or determine it. It would not stand for itself in opposition to the larger truth of things or dictate a personally impelled departure from the divinely willed true movement. This opposition and departure can happen in ignorance, where love or any other strong principle of the nature can be divorced from wisdom, even as it can be divorced from power. But in the supermind, gnosis, all powers are intimate to each other and act as one. In the Gnostic person, the truth knowledge would lead and determine, and all the other forces of the being concur in the action. There would be no place for harmony or conflict between the powers of the nature. In all action, there is an imperative of existence that seeks to be fulfilled. A truth of being not yet manifested has to be manifested, or a truth manifesting has to be evolved and achieved and perfected in manifestation, or if already achieved, to take its delight of being and self-effectuation. In the half-light and half-power of the ignorance, the imperative is secret or only half-revealed, and the push to fulfillment is an imperfect, struggling, partly frustrated movement. But in the Gnostic being and life of the imperatives of being would be felt within, intimately perceived and brought into action. There would be a free play of their possibilities. There would be an actualization in accordance with the truth of circumstance and the intention in the supernature. All this would be seen in the knowledge and develop itself in act. There would be no uncertain combat or torment of forces at work. A disharmony of the being, a contradictory working of the consciousness, could have no place. The imposition of an external standardization of mechanized law would be entirely superfluous, where there is this inherence of truth and its spontaneous working in act of nature. A harmonic action, a working out of the divine motive, an execution of the imperative truth of things would be the law and natural dynamics of the whole existence.
So this is a continuation of this idea of freedom and order an individual, but he pushes it one step further in talking about the different kinds of ideals that belong to us, that belong in the cosmos. So we find that when we talked about the three levels or stages, states of divine being, that at the individual level by itself, even if we take separativeness out of it, if we talk about even a soul life, a life of the soul, we find that there is a certain kind of partiality there. This reason for that is exactly this fact of fragmentation, which is the law of the ignorance. The fragmentation is not merely a fragmentation of individual consciousnesses. It is also a fragmentation of varieties of consciousness. It is also a fragmentation of the various ideals or ideal consciousnesses. The varieties of consciousnesses he has already touched on in terms of the various things he mentioned. The mental consciousness, the consciousness of the emotional consciousness, consciousness of will and consciousness of body. But there is also a whole play of ideals. This is another very important philosophical problem that has perplexed humanity through the ages, which is that even if we don't talk about a duality between good and evil, the problem of action is beset between a variety of choices. You find that if a certain thing is to be done, there can be a variety of ideal ways of doing it. Each one of them poses to be the best way possible. These ideals, from a certain point of view, are the gods. Each one of these ideals, like, let's say, for example, liberty, equality, good, beauty, all these various ideals stand in themselves as a certain acme of perfection towards which we are attracted. Now, everybody is not attracted towards the same sun, if you want to call these ideals these gods or suns. And our movement towards the solution of the same problem will differ according to our gravitation towards one or the other of these ideals. This kind of fragmentation of ideals is also part of the whole idea of overmind and of the dismemberment of the one, which is the condition of ignorance. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out over here is, actually, as I mentioned, this is a very old philosophical problem. Plato tried to solve this problem by saying that Plato said that there is a world of pure ideas, and ultimately at the very heights of creation, these pure ideas exist in harmony with one another. Actually, in the Sri Aurobindo's terminology, this would be the overmind. This would be the world of the gods, where the gods know themselves to be distinct, but at the same time know themselves to be various formulations of the one. Therefore, according to Plato, and of course this is a very high ideal, he said that if we, without trying to get into distinctions and differences with others, from an internal point of view, if each individual designs their life around one of these great ideals with the faith that at the very height of their realization, they will find that these are all harmonious with one another. All these ideals coexist. These ideals are a circle of friends. This is the way in which Plato saw the solution of the problem. And of course, he was right, in the sense that in overmind that harmony is achieved. But to reach there is a very distant goal. And in the meantime, we find that there is a tremendous disharmony even among ideals in the world. The most obvious one of these has to do with the big difference between liberty and equality that the modern world is full of in terms of strife and conflict. We find that liberty, in a narrow sense, moves towards capitalism, and equality moves towards a communalistic ideal where everybody is forcibly equalized. So we find that each of these ideals, narrowly understood in the world of life, creates certain problems that don't, you know, bring harmony to the expression. But what he's saying over here is that these problems are overcome, not only in the sense of rising to an overmind level, but again, intimately, in mind, life, and body, through a spontaneous identification, because all of these ideals belong to the same one consciousness. Therefore, depending on what is necessary, this is the, you know, the undivided power, the Aditi Shakti, or Adya Shakti, that manifests the various aspects of its own divine power, Shakti, where and when needed, without any, sort of bias or inequality towards one or the other. This kind of integrality belongs to supramental action, and in that sort of action, as he says, the one will of the divine and the individual will, the separated individual will, come together in a seamless way. The individual lives in the supreme divine, in a sense, perceives and acts out of that particular consciousness.
Janet, what do you want to read next? Are you there, Janet? Is Alexandra there, Louise?
Yes. Hold on. She's coming.
Acknowledged by identity using the powers of the integrated being, the richness of instrumentation with the principle of the supramental life. In the other grades of the Gnostic being, although a truth of spiritual being and consciousness would fulfill itself, the instrumentation would be of a different order. A higher mental being would act through the truth of thought, the truth of the idea, and accomplish that in the life action. But in the supramental gnosis, thought is a derivative movement, is formulation of truth vision and not the determining or the main driving force. It would be an instrument for expression of knowledge more than for arrival at knowledge or for action.
Oh, I was just reading.
Yeah. Just 1 minute. I think I'm having a little difficulty.
By identity using the powers of the integrated being for richness of instrumentation would be the principle of the supramental life. In the other grades of the Gnostic being, although a truth of spiritual being and consciousness would fulfill itself, the instrumentation would be of a different order. A higher mental being would act through the truth of thought, the truth of the idea, and accomplish that in the life action. But in the supramental gnosis, thought is a derivative movement. It is a formulation of truth vision and not the determining or the main driving force. It would be an instrument for expression of knowledge more than for arrival at knowledge or for action. Or it would intervene in action only as a penetrating point of the body of identity will and identity knowledge. So too in the illumined Gnostic being, truth vision, and in the intuitive Gnostic being, a direct truth contact and perceptive truth sense would be the mainspring of action. In the overmind, a comprehensive immediate grasp of the truth of things and the principle of being of each thing and all its dynamic consequences would originate and gather up the great wideness of mystic vision and thought and create a foundation of knowledge and action. This largeness of being and seeing and doing would be the varied result of an underlying identity consciousness, but the identity itself would not be in the front as the very stuff of the consciousness or the very force of the action. But in the supramental gnosis, all this luminous immediate grasp of the truth of things, truth sense, truth vision, truth thought, would get back into its source of identity consciousness and subsist as a single body of its knowledge. The identity consciousness would lead and contain everything. It would manifest as an awareness in the very grain of the being substance, putting forth its inherent self-filling force and determining itself dynamically in form of consciousness and form of action. This inherent awareness is the origin and principle of the working of supramental gnosis. It could be sufficient in itself, with no need of anything to formulate or embody it, but the play of illumined vision, the play of a radiant thought, the play of all the other movements of the spiritual consciousness would not be absent. There would be a free instrumentation of them with their own brilliant functioning, for a divine richness and diversity, for a manifold delight of self-manifestation, for the joy of the powers of the infinite. In the intermediate stages or degrees of the gnosis, there might be the manifestation of various and separate expressions of the aspects of the divine being and nature, a soul and life of love, a soul and life of divine light and knowledge, a soul and life of divine power and sovereign action and creation, and innumerable other forms of divine life. On the supramental height, all would be taken up into a manifold unity, a supreme integration of being and life, a fulfillment of the being in a luminous and blissful integration of its states and powers, and their satisfied dynamic action would be the sense of the gnostic existence.
So, in this rather long and really very rich paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is continuing, I would say, his exposition of these various gods or these various fragmentary powers of the divine which are available in our lives in the ignorance. Just as we can see this fragmentation and this world of the gods, in the variety of gods in terms of various forms of consciousness, there are certain Upanishads that see it like that. For example, when we talk about mind, emotion, life, and body, each one of these pertains to a certain modality of consciousness with a certain being behind it. Now, certain Upanishads look at the whole mental power as emerging out of Indra and some aspects of the vital power emerging out of Vayu or the god of breath or the wind. Other aspects emerging out of Varuna or out of Mitra and etc. Now, another way of looking at the gods is what we talked about just in the last paragraph, where he speaks about these ideals, the great ideals of light, love, life, duty, harmony, good, etc. Are like the gods, again, or are the gods who have been fragmented as qualities, and yet each one of them is a kind of an attractor of our lives. Yet, acting separately, they even work at odds against each other often, which is what gives this tremendous sense of strife to even the religious life of man on the earth. All following different ideals, but ideals at odds with each other, or even the political life of man, that matter. Now, this paragraph is a very rich one because we can still see it in terms of the lives of the gods, but in a very deep and esoteric way connected with the inner life. Now, some of the Upanishads talk about the gods as the senses, particularly when we think about the emergence of consciousness. And when we think of the archetypal human, which I was saying right at the peaks of creation, there can be an archetypal human, supramental Purusha. This is a formation which has got powers of experiencing. these powers experiencing are externalized in terms of senses. And these senses are each one of them again fragmented in their action in the ignorance. So these fragmented senses are active in our lives as the organs of knowledge. And these organs of knowledge have various types of actions. At the lowest level, we know them as the doors of our senses through which we receive the impressions of the world. And we process them to get a certain picture of knowledge of the world. These senses also relate to sensations. Sensations relate to feelings. So senses mediate between cognition and feeling, world of cognition and world of feelings. There are both mental and vital properties as well as physical properties that the senses convey to the various modalities of consciousness inside us. But in their inner reality, the senses open onto another world, the dream world, the world of Swapna or Rini, the subjective world or the subliminal world. Now, this world, this inner world, is one in which these senses again work in fragmentary ways but reveal their godheads. Each one of our senses, as it were, again, has a certain divine power behind it. And Sri Aurobindo is now seeing the origin of these divine powers of the senses in the heaven worlds above mind. These are what he calls the subsidiary Gnostic planes. So the subsidiary Gnostic planes he touches on over here start from what he calls the higher mind. As far as the human mind is concerned, human mind is a